they decided, the top teams in those leagues, hey, why are we sharing all this money with these second-rate teams in our leagues?
With West Brom Albion.
Pardon me?
I said with West Brom Albion.
Exactly. A team that, and I follow soccer, and I'm not even sure I know where that is.
Hi, and welcome to GeekWire. I'm GeekWire co-founder John Cook. We're coming to you from Seattle, where we report each day on what's happening around us in technology, science, and innovation. What happens here matters everywhere, and every week on this show, we talk about some of the biggest and most interesting stories we've been covering. Here's what we're talking about this week. Washington state legislators appear to be on track to pass a new capital gains tax for the state that would be collected on large sales of stocks and more. But tech industry leaders warn it might harm the startup scene in the state. Meanwhile, Amazon weighed in on a proposed European Super League of soccer and said it didn't like the idea for, get this, its anti-competitiveness. Did Amazon's opposition help scuttle the idea? We'll discuss. But first, Washington State is poised to make a significant change in how its citizens get access to the internet. Governor Jay Inslee has indicated he'll sign two pieces of legislation that will allow municipalities to set up their own direct-to-consumer broadband services. Access to broadband became a critical issue during the pandemic for thousands across the state. Joining us today to discuss these issues is GeekWire reporter Mike Lewis, who covered many of these stories. Mike, welcome back to the GeekWire podcast.
Happy to be here, John, as always.
Yeah, so let's dive in on broadband. This is an issue that goes way back. I know we both have covered over the years of this idea of communities or cities or counties, for that matter, municipalities, really owning the internet infrastructure and providing broadband to its citizens. So there were some changes that came down this week. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened and what this might mean?
Yeah, the changes are not yet written into law because the governor has yet to sign them. But what the governor is going to do, has said he is going to do, is this. He's going to allow municipalities, essentially public utilities districts, port districts, things like that, to run their own broadband service. And while they've been able to sort of put in infrastructure in the past, that's been legal. What they've not been able to do is have what they refer to as a retail relationship. In other words, sending the actual bill, billing the customers for this thing. This is something that has been pretty strongly opposed by the cable industry, of course, because they see it as a loss of money. And they also see a capacity for governments to be able to offer subsidies and lower cost internet because they can amortize it over across many customers and other government services than the actual cable companies can. So they see a double loss here. And where it really started for Washington State, at least the push at the state level, was actually in Kitsap County and its public utilities district that was founded in the 1930s.
Yeah, so this is, as I said, something that's been around for a while. I know the city of Tacoma had a municipal broadband network that they experimented with. Even in Seattle, there was an effort that kind of failed miserably. What are your thoughts on whether this is a good idea or a bad idea?
Wow, I think that it's a great idea. I mean, I think that, let me tell you a little bit about what Kitsap is doing. That's the story that I'm working on now for GeekWire, and it speaks to maybe a structure that might work for everyone. Kitsap, years ago, put in the infrastructure for high-speed internet, but just sent it to all the buildings, you know, the schools, the hospitals, the sheriff's office, places like that. And the funny thing is that the people working in these places immediately contacted the district when they got put online and said, this is better internet than I've ever had at my house. My DSL is terrible. And so what happened at that point was the district started thinking, well, can we actually provide this service to individual residences? Because Kitsap County, for example, is one of those counties, like many in Washington State, that has completely unserved or underserved areas. In addition to the fact that even in a place like Bremerton, which is pretty urban, there is a percentage of kids in school whose families can't even afford internet access. And so they saw a real need here, and that's what got them pushing to make the changes at the state. So now, after the governor signs this, the municipalities, in the same exact manner that they can provide electricity or water or sewer or garbage, are going to be able to also offer you internet hookup. But what Kitsap is going to do is a little bit different. What Kitsap is going to do is they are going to, and in fact, I've got a quote from I interviewed the Bob Hunter, who was the director of Kitsap PUD, the KPUD as it's referred to there. And he said that he is looking to create a situation by which they create the pipeline. In other words, they build the roadway and the internet companies actually drive the trucks on it. So they're going to put it, make it an open access system. So they can still have internet companies providing the actual broadband, but with very clear stipulations by the district that is actually going to build out the entire infrastructure.
Our whole model has been the idea that open access, meaning that let PUDs build infrastructure. That's what we do. That's what we do well. And let the privates compete on price and service over our network.
So, Mike, that's really interesting. So is the idea then that essentially, as you mentioned, kind of the major infrastructure groundwork is provided by the community itself, and then they're asking these companies to come in and run on that backbone. I guess my question there is, some of these counties, especially in more rural areas, have had a real hard time getting companies to come in to their communities to operate. Is this a cost reduction plan? Because a lot of the backbone has been laid already, so it's less risky for like a Comcast or a Lumen to come in and compete or participate in their broadband service?
You're asking a very interesting question, and the answer is not, it's a little more complicated, but here's a couple things that are going to happen. Well, one, for a Kitsap Public Utilities to be able to afford to put in this infrastructure or to help it be able to afford to put in this infrastructure, there's a couple of pools of money out there. One, you're a district that can float a bond, so you can actually finance it fairly affordably that way. But two, there's entire pots of money that are available for districts to do this. The problem was in Washington State, we literally made it illegal for districts to do this. So they were not even allowed to grab at that money that was already available. So two things are going to happen. With the change in law, the districts are going to be able to go after that federal money, and it'll actually out, which will allow them, because you need to have a retail relationship to have access to these giant pots of money that are sitting at the federal level. So one, they'll be able to do that. But two, they can also, where they can't do that, they can also finance it at a municipal bond level relatively affordably. So it's almost zero risk for the companies, because this essentially it's going to be just like WashDOT building a road. WashDOT's going to build out the road. What you put on it and how fast you drive is going to be up to you. Here's this though. What Kitsap is going to do, and I suspect other public utility districts are going to follow, is require a minimum upload and download speed all the time. In other words, you're not going to be able to get on there as Comcast and throttle back until someone pays you a lot more. They're actually going to put parameters on it that are going to require you to meet a minimum standard, or they're going to have the right to boot you right off, which I think is a great thing for utility payers, because you're going to get that competition that people want to exist, you know, in mainstream capitalism, but you're also going to get that guarantee that the government actually owns that road. And if the government owns that road, ostensibly that means the taxpayers own that road, and you'll be able to boot people out who are actually cluttering up the road or using it in a way that wasn't intended.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You certainly can see this working in more rural areas, like you mentioned with Kitsap County, which is west of King County, where Seattle is located on the peninsula. But do you see this going into more urban environments and having a role there?
Absolutely. I mean, what's going to happen here also, the secondary nature to all of this is that these municipalities are now going to be able to subsidize for folks who can't afford internet. The two big problems that the pandemic revealed, and this one I was talking with Bob Hunter at Kitsap PUD, he said this, and he said it caught him very off guard. When the pandemic started 1 year ago, they met with the school districts and said, what can we do to help? And they said, we have two problems. One was we have kids without good internet access where they're living. But in, for example, in Bremerton schools, which is fairly urban, it wasn't a matter of internet access. There already was internet access there. The problem was that there are so many families who actually literally couldn't afford the $100 a month for decent, worthwhile upload speeds for broadband. And that was the other thing, that the district literally could not legally provide a subsidized internet account. It can now. Or it will be able to once this becomes law. It's going to be able to actually offer low cost. That had been borne by the schools. So the schools were distributing these Wi-Fi hotspots, some of which worked well, some of which didn't work well. You couldn't have multiple devices on at the same time. These families were really not getting any level of access that they needed to actually have both their own ability to work. Many of the parents were home, and the kids' ability to learn. In fact, I know frequently when I was doing interviews back when I was at Cairo Radio, you would call someone who would actually boot their kids off the internet so they could actually deal with you on a conference call in some manner when you're doing an interview. And that seems to me like maybe not what we should be doing here, particularly when it came to at-home learning.
Yeah, or you heard the stories of folks having to drive like to a McDonald's or something and work in a parking lot. Hopefully this does take root to a degree, because I think the pandemic did show that there were large disparities as it related to internet access in this country. So I think maybe this is a step towards that.
I think this is a step toward that. And in Washington State, a state that really is known as a high-tech state, it had vast stretches that are not underserved, not served whatsoever. And so if you can, and remember what the internet companies did, what they promised to do was not what they actually did. What the internet companies did, the big cable providers, the CenturyLinks and the Comcasts of this world, the Waves of this world, what they did was cull all of the easy stuff. So they grabbed all of that and were happy to charge for that, but they weren't willing to go in places that they couldn't actually pencil out. And that was always the problem with allowing this to be privatized, was that a lot of communities went unserved. If we did that with electricity, literally you'd have cities or municipalities in Washington State without electricity, because they would just take the private electric companies would just have taken the low-hanging fruit. So I think this actually is it becomes a bigger issue, an equity issue, as much as it becomes anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, another emerging technology here to keep an eye on is Starlink and Project Kuiper.
Exactly.
Project Kuiper being the internet access from the sky provided by Amazon, Starlink being the component of SpaceX with Elon Musk that's trying to provide internet connectivity no matter where anybody is, based on internet connectivity from satellites. And that also could potentially solve part of this issue. And I know some of those large cable companies are running a bit scared of that effort as well.
There's actually a subtle point to be made there. Another person I was talking to is an expert on this stuff, said, yeah, but this also has been an argument against adding more infrastructure. In other words, why would you dig a bunch of pipes everywhere all over the state when it potentially can be delivered by satellite? And maybe we're jumping a little too early into this building of infrastructure, because it's enormously expensive to if you're in Mount Baker school district, for example, to put in actual pipe to run to fiber optic cable to run internet everywhere, when maybe, you know, you wait 2 years and suddenly it's available by satellite. And so that's an interesting dynamic that also is going to affect how quickly districts move toward providing some form of broadband service.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting area. Thanks for writing the story, Mike, and I'm looking forward to your continued coverage on this. So coming up next, we're going to look at a controversial Washington State bill that would impose a state capital gains tax. Would it hurt startups in the state? We'll talk about that after the break. Welcome back to GeekWire. I'm John Cook. We're talking about the week's tech news with GeekWire reporter Mike Lewis. Legislation that appears headed for passage in Washington state would impose a capital gains tax on the state for the first time. Opponents call it an income tax, which makes it unconstitutional in their minds. And a tech industry group warns it could make the region unattractive to startups. Mike, you covered this story for us this week. What's going on here? Talk about the battle between the startup community and why they're largely opposed to this, and what the other side of the fence here and why they think this is the time to maybe raise more money for the state through a capital gains tax.
Well, for anyone who's interested in capital gains taxes, and I imagine you are from a financial standpoint, do not expect this discussion to end anytime soon. Washington State right now is in the process of negotiating an additional 7%. Now, Washington State doesn't actually charge capital gains taxes. Some states do, some states don't. Washington doesn't. And Washington's issue with this idea is that income taxes are effectively prevented by the state constitution. They're banned by the state constitution. It's going to take a fairly serious effort to get that changed. And so the people who are in favor of a capital gains tax in Washington state are calling this one an excise tax, and they feel like they have the law behind them. Of course, the opponents say this effectively amounts to an income tax and is going to be illegal. So whatever happens in Washington state, as far as this bill moving through, guarantee it is going to end up in court, because there's a good precedence for legal challenge to this. There's also a decent precedence, of course, with the last decision on Seattle's effort to put in an income tax. There's precedent there that also kind of opens the court's ability to interpret this as an excise tax. An excise tax is, you know, for those who don't know, it's essentially a sales tax. So it is what you pay every time you buy a product anywhere. Unless you're buying that product wholesale, you are paying an excise tax. My business, which on the side is a bar here in Seattle, we pay thousands of dollars a month in excise taxes. Essentially, you're a tax collection agency for the state when you're paying an excise tax. They never consider that your money anyway. It passes through straight to the state. And if this is the way a capital gains tax is characterized by judges, where it will end up, then this will go through, and it will be sizable, primarily on stock sales. That's really what it's targeting, over $250,000. So nothing below that. It's actually bypassing things like real estate. It's not deciding to tax any of those things. It's fairly narrow, because what they're trying to do is get wealth that they feel like is specific to high income people that doesn't actually generate, you know, more jobs on its own. They're leaving out a lot of those areas that may be wealth owned by people who don't have a lot of wealth, which would be a real estate sale. For example, you're selling your grandfather's house who passed away or moved into a retirement community. Those sort of things are carved out of this potential capital gains tax in Washington state.
So, Mike, why is this such a big deal for technology companies and the venture capital firms that fund those companies, and why they are largely opposed to this? I mean, you see the Washington Technology Industry Association has come out largely against this. They represent more than 1,000 tech companies in the state. What's their beef?
Well, their beef is twofold. I mean, their beef with Washington state is that the capital gains tax, this particular tax, targets the way that they compensate people and they compensate executives. It exactly is right in the wheelhouse of people who get paid. A friend of mine just got a nice raise, an unusually high one, at Amazon, because he did a pretty great project for them over the course of the last year, and they surprised him with additional stock. Well, that is right in the wheelhouse of what would be taxed at a much higher rate. I mean, an additional 7% is not chump change, and it's going to raise potentially a lot of money for the state if it ever becomes legal. And so the tech companies in particular, because this is their preferred form of compensation in many cases, this is how you keep employees, this is how you lure employees, well, they feel like this is going to be a major impediment to the way they do their business.
Yeah, and it's not only for the employees, it's also, as I understand it, at the time of a sale.
Absolutely, yes.
You know, so a company that, an entrepreneur who's built his or her company over the last 5 or 10 years could see a real increase in capital gains tax as this. In fact, one of our sources that we've been going to for additional context in this, because obviously diving into tax law is not the easiest thing to digest. But he told us that the spike in capital gains the year an entrepreneur sells his or her company, the tax hit increase could be enormous. And this is not only because of the state tax, which is now being debated, but I wanted to ask you, because simultaneously to this discussion, we've got President Biden, who's also now putting forth new efforts as it relates to a federal capital gains tax. So the combination of those two, you're looking at a pretty significant increase, correct, in terms of what the tax hit could be to those who might see this in play?
Oh, yeah. So if you add in now the federal tax increase, and the federal tax increase is much more broadly interpreting conventional capital gains, I mean, the whole gamut of capital gains. The Biden administration has proposed, 36% effective capital gains tax rate. The thought is that that's the proposal. They're going to back it out to probably 30% is where they want to negotiate it down to, and they feel like that is palatable. There have been very wealthy people, you know, who are actually in favor of adding to the capital gains tax. Warren Buffett, Jamie Dimon at JP Morgan Chase, another person who has actually said that it probably is time to revisit that tax, the loopholes contained in capital gains tax right now. So, but if you're not eligible for one of those loopholes, and if you are, you know, a little closer to the edge financially, and what you're doing is not in any of the exempted areas in Washington state or at the federal level, you're going to see a fairly sizable increase in capital gains taxes. One other thing, though, that I meant to mention earlier. So I was texting earlier today with Noelle Frame. She is the representative who put together the capital gains tax in Washington state, the one that the state is literally in the middle right now of debating, and they need to finish it by Sunday to get that thing moved through and onto the governor's desk. And she said that she sent me the actual polling that has been done on this issue, and it's pretty, not among Republicans, but it's pretty popular in Washington state to add the capital gains tax. Now, popularity won't affect the state Supreme Court where this is likely to end up, but it's another point worth noting that the capital gains issue is not terribly unpopular. And I think that's why Governor Inslee is in favor of it and why the Biden administration also is.
Yeah, the other argument you've heard here from Republicans, you've heard it from components of the venture capital community, which we're in contact with all the time, is that Washington state is actually flush with cash right now.
Right.
And the fact that we're getting this additional federal stimulus money that's coming in to help support additional programs. And so the argument, as I understand it, is, hey, we actually don't really need this money right now. And why don't we use our tax funds we have a little more efficiently and effectively, given the flush state we are in? What's the counter argument to that? Because it seems like a relatively strong argument.
So the counter argument would be that, well, we're flush now. We will not necessarily be flush in 3 years. A lot of this loss in tax revenue is being masked by a big dollop of cash from the feds. Building programs around one-time cash dispersals is always a bad idea. I mean, it'd be like getting a $1,000 bonus on your check and buying a new car. Well, you still got payments. You know, you've still got outside costs moving forward. But the other point of it is this, that this is not an issue of capital gains tax needing it this year. The bigger issue here is the structure of the tax code in Washington state. Because Washington state doesn't have an income tax, it really front loads sales taxes and other taxes that opponents of such taxes would call regressive. The taxes that take a larger percent of a poor person's income than of a wealthy person's income, or of a low income person's income than a wealthy person's income. That would, sales tax is a perfect example of that, or gas taxes, things like that. And so the idea that the state needs another income stream that is not property taxes and not sales taxes has been a discussion in Washington state since the 1930s. This is nothing new. And so they see an opportunity, the Democrats and the people who want to see a change to the tax code, see this as a perfect opportunity to get this change through. Remember, the Democrats have the House the House and the Senate in Washington state and the governor's office. So if they're going to get something like this through, and if they can get it characterized as an excise tax, they win, and they actually do manage to do some restructuring of tax code in Washington state.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's the big kind of mega picture of what's going on here, is that, and you've heard this for many years, that Washington state has one of the most regressive tax systems, where, you know, I think poor people pay 18% and wealthy people pay, you know, 3% of their income, or
bingo,
stats around those levels. And it does seem unfair. And I think that is the bigger question of what's going on here, is using this opportunity to try to fix what many see as an unfair tax system.
Absolutely. I mean, you remember, a lot of the legislation we're going to see from tax law, this municipal broadband thing, the underpinning of all of this is this, you know, this new awareness of equity and how certain things are built, baked into the system that maybe should never have been baked into the system. And the way the system treats people with access as opposed to people without access, even though it's ostensibly supposed to be even across the board. And so I think that you can categorize a lot of these things as this larger push. And I think sometimes there's going to be a lot of criticism that is this actually, you know, an equity push or not? I mean, I think that those things are fair to discuss on a case-by-case basis. But I think the larger idea here is that it is, as the economy polarizes, do we need to do more to allow access for people on the lower end of that economy to at least climb upward? And I think that is what the broadband issue and the capital gains tax issues are largely trying to solve.
Yeah, absolutely. And great job covering these two issues, Mike. I know you're going to be covering them here in the future. We've been diving into the weeds of public policy in Washington State with broadband and taxes. And when we come back after the break, we're going to dive into something a little bit more fun. I think it's a passion area of Mike's and mine, soccer and Amazon's role in the proposed and now failed European Super League. We will be back right after the break. You're listening to GeekWire. Welcome back to GeekWire. I'm GeekWire co-founder John Cook, talking with GeekWire reporter Mike Lewis about the week's tech news. And Mike, this story, I don't know if you would classify typically as a tech story as much as a sports story, but we are both soccer geeks. And as soon as I saw this news break Sunday night, we've got a thread of about four or five of us who follow soccer. And I sent the news about the Super League, which was formed in, it seemed like, a night and failed maybe two nights later. This was fascinating. And there are some interesting tech parallels here that I want to get into. But first, maybe you can set the stage on the Super League and why we're talking about it here on the GeekWire podcast.
Yeah, so the Super League, and the funny thing is that the Super League, if you don't follow soccer, but you do follow Division I football, you'll find some parallels here. So the Super League is this idea to cull the top earner teams, the top popularity teams from the big leagues in Europe. The big leagues would be the Premier League, the Bundesliga, which is German, Serie A, which is the Italian league, La Liga, which is the Spanish league. And these are the four most popular sports leagues, not the four most popular soccer league, the four most popular sports leagues in the world, the Premier League being the king among kings. These are the big billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar earners. They decided the top teams in those leagues, which earn the bulk of the money and also draw the bulk of the fans, decided, hey, why are we sharing all this money with poor, you know, these second-rate teams in our leagues?
With West Brom Albion.
Pardon me?
With West Brom Albion.
Exactly. Yeah. A team that, and I follow soccer, and I'm not even sure I know where that is. They decided, you know, why don't we just take our toys and make our own league and do a fair revenue sharing, weirdly enough, very much in the model of, say, the NFL, to do a revenue sharing thing so we can actually collect more of that money. Because the downside to being a top team in the Premier League, for example, is your salary load would make, you know, would threaten an NFL billionaire. I mean, they really are enormous salaries in this league. Now, they did it to themselves, so you can't really, you know, cut them a lot of sympathy in that regard. So they tried to do this, and then immediately the backlash from the individual leagues that they are members of, FIFA, which is kind of the overlord of all soccer in the world, they all immediately snapped back and said, fine, we're going to take away everything else you have if we need to stop you from doing this. And immediately teams that had secretly joined the Super League started peeling away rapidly and leaving it's just a pile of ash. Like you said, John, 3 days after they formed it, it was already dead.
Yeah, and it was also the fans and players and many coaches were coming against this. It wasn't just the lower clubs or the governing body of FIFA. So it was like almost everybody except these rich oligarchs that had thought this was a good idea came out against it. And it was interesting from a PR disaster how quickly it did just crash and burn.
Well, and also it became, you know, and I know that there's no real shortage of these issues internationally. It also became a strongly anti-American pry bar tool because there are American hedge funds that are big investors now in these teams. And they're the ones who actually, I think, were, some would say, a really good story in The Athletic about this, that they are the ones agitating for a more American-style league. Now, in its defense of the Super League, and actually, if you look at it closely, there's a lot of things defendable about it. One, One of the things we still do very, very well in the United States is run profitable sports leagues. We do it better than anybody on the planet. Our leagues actually, one, make money, and two, provide parity. This whole idea of parity almost seems fundamentally American, right? We create a, like, the bottom to top draft. All of the things we do are to give the Tampa Bays of this world, the Green Bays of this world, a shot at a title, a shot at actually equalizing with a big market team. That does not happen in the Premier League. In the Bundesliga, if you're Bayern Munich, you're going to win a championship, what, every other year. And so it is, I think that there's a lot of good about the Super League that maybe got overlooked in this idea because they're all really super wealthy hedge funds or wealthy, you know, Russian oligarchs or whatever who own these teams. Because we actually structure a pretty good league in this country, and that's what they were really trying to do here. But wow, there is so much history and so much inertia in international soccer that trying to do something like this, it would be like, I don't know, you know, making any changes to Major League Baseball. They're so steeped in history that sometimes they can't get out of their own way to actually change a structure that might benefit the league overall.
Yeah, and I want to bring this back into our theme of technology here on the GeekWire podcast. Mike, one of the ways I've been thinking about this is imagine if you had Google, Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft, and Twitter come together and decide, we're going to create a super platform. And right. We're going to be this super platform. We're going to collect all this data on you so we can serve you as customers better. I mean, that's how ill-conceived, I think, this concept was of the Super League and how out of touch these sports owners were with these mega teams. Because can you imagine if these large technology companies had thought about doing something like that? I mean, it's just like the public opinion is not with you on where you're at. So that's one point I would make, just the parallels between how big these sports leagues are and how big tech is now being perceived. So I think there's some interesting parallels there. The other thing I was going to ask is that Amazon, of all companies, weighed into this issue, which was surprising to me. You had a story on this. Why in the world did they get involved?
Well, one of the thoughts was that you could have actually done this league if you decide if the money was going to follow you. So if you could get a major multi-billion dollar sponsor to say, hey, we'll back this. Suddenly, you know, a Visa or Coke or whomever decides to do it, yeah, that then you maybe have a shot. Well, the speculation had been that Amazon, which has stepped strongly into the sports streaming business over the course of the last few years, I mean, it streams Sounders games for MLS, it streams Premier League games right now, that Amazon might be the company that is interested in backing this move. And Amazon, it became such a popular notion that Amazon felt compelled. Amazon's sports video streaming division felt compelled to issue a press release. And the press release, you know, I'd say only 250,000 people noticed the inherent irony in it. Amazon said that they thought the existing structure was good and that they felt this new structure was, quote, anti-competitive, which was, you know, for a company that is right in the middle of an antitrust investigation, suggesting that that it's uncomfortable with something that is anti-competitive gave more than one person a chuckle.
That was a good headline, I think, that you put together on that, which was very interesting to see Amazon coming out. So what's next, do you think, here as it relates to the Super League, sports in general, these large technology organizations that are kind of joined at the hip in many ways? What are your thoughts on how this ends up?
Well, I mean, the Super League is dead. I think that what it did really was nothing good. It severed a lot of really good relationships. If you want to look at the death of the Super League, the best story on it that I've read so far is in the New York Times, and essentially is a TikTok on when this secret meetings, turned off cell phones, all kinds of great. It's like reading a spy novel. A really great story on how this thing came together and then just completely exploded. But where do I think it's headed? I actually am a little bit of a defender of the Super League concept, except in this one area. I do think that these leagues and their streaming deals and the way they make their money, they're going to have to find some way to embrace some form of socialism that their governments often have already embraced, because you can't really run a league I think, effectively anymore, where you're, the top teams are almost more crushed by their salaries than the bottom teams are. And you have the situation where, you know, the Spanish team, Barcelona, one of the most famous popular teams in the world, arguably maybe the most popular team in the world, can't afford, I think it's paying its star, it leaked some salary data, $130 million a year. I mean, an astounding amount of money. They want some help. And this league, if they could have formed it, it meant that they were going to get a cash infusion of $4 billion. I think the tech world, particularly Amazon, which wants badly into this market, I think that there is going to be a restructuring. I think you're going to find that the Instagrams of this world, Twitter, which has started its own streaming of sporting events as well, I think they're going to be big players in some sort of financial restructuring of a lot of these leagues, because everyone knows when you have 1 billion fans, everybody wants into that pool. And so my guess is some of these companies are going to be looking at a very, very serious investment here. It's just a matter of how these leagues structured, I guess.
Well, yeah, you saw Amazon pay the NFL $1 billion for Thursday night football, $1 billion.
For one day of football a week.
$1 billion. So there is big money. And as you mentioned, the traditional way that these games have been broadcast, especially with the global nature of soccer, especially, it really is set up for streaming.
Totally.
I mean, I think it's Manchester United that has 50 million fans just in China, and one Premier League team. And so it's like, wouldn't it make sense to have a streaming deal that is just massive?
Bingo.
That you're able to take the games for your special team or your teams that you love and have that broadcast to all global fans versus the way it's kind of parsed up now.
Totally. I mean, your point about the $1 billion that Amazon is paying. I mean, think about this for a moment. This is Amazon paying for a domestic league one day a week, and it's $1 billion. Now, let's look at Manchester United, which the fans of the Manchester United are as large as the NFL. Really? I mean, that is, if you add in China, you add in India, you add in Germany, you add Manchester United fans all throughout South America and in the United States, suddenly you've got an enormous pot of money available, and that's just one team. So without any question, the numbers that we're talking about are almost difficult to comprehend when the leagues start doing this. And you're right. I mean, if you are broadcasting these things all over the world, streaming is the only way you're effectively going to be able to do that. And it's going to allow people to watch, you know, to do no work at all and do nothing all day but watch soccer, which is not necessarily a bad way to live.
Yeah, and I might have misspoke there, Mike, because I think my numbers might have been outdated, or there's probably multiple numbers on this. But another survey that I just found said that Man United has 253 million fans and followers in China. So you're getting up to almost the population of the United States, just their fans. Increase of 108 million in 7 years, you know, so. So it's probably even much bigger than that at this point.
Well, and the other company that apparently has been talking about, sort of that has been rumoring, is Netflix even. I mean, Netflix is finding that some of these things it's doing in the sports world are enormously popular. Its new reality series on Formula One, suddenly everyone's lining up. Even NASCAR is talking to them about doing something similar in American League, which is because it's become so popular, and its popularity as a series has made the sports broadcast rights more valuable, because now more people who are casual observers or not observers at all are now watching this sport, because it really is, and I've watched the series, it's dynamite. And you're going to find that even the Netflix of this world and these ones that are more traditional kind of movie and television house, HBO's, you know, whatnot, they're all now staring hard at this potential market, because it is going to be a lucrative one.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I know we were following the Super League very closely for its 3 days of existence, and rest in peace, Super League. I'm glad it's gone.
I'm sorry, because we had all ginned up the Super League podcast,
right,
and now we're not
right.
Going to be able to do it.
Well, anyway, it was good to bring it back into tech there with something, tech and soccer, a couple of our passions. So thanks to everybody for listening to GeekWire. To see all of GeekWire's coverage of science, tech, business, and more, go to geekwire.com and sign up for our daily email newsletter to receive all of our stories. Our podcast producer is Kurt Milton. Our theme music is by Daniel L.K. Caldwell. I am GeekWire co-founder John Cook.
And I'm GeekWire reporter Mike Lewis.
We'll see you next week on the GeekWire podcast.